This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Alessandra Tanasini. Alessandra is professor of philosophy at Cardiff University. She specializes in epistemology, ethics, and the philosophy of language, and the intersections of these fields. Her new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled The Mismeasure of the Self, A Study in Vice Epistemology. Now, a lot of epistemology focuses on the analysis of central epistemological concepts, things like knowledge and justification, evidence, truth, and belief. But having knowledge is also a matter of acquiring knowledge. And this means that epistemology should also address questions about our conduct in acquiring knowledge. How should we go about finding things out? What does it mean to be a good inquirer? Questions like that. This suggests that people can behave badly or improperly as epistemic agents. So it falls also to epistemologists to examine bad epistemic conduct as well. Now, in her new book, The Mismeasure of the Self, Alessandra begins from the observation that good epistemic conduct involves proper appraisal of one's epistemic condition, including one's own cognitive strengths and weaknesses. Her book is focused on the ways in which epistemic self-assessment can go wrong. Along the way, she provides a general theory of epistemic virtue and vice. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about here. But before we get into all the details, why don't we begin, as we usually do, with our guest, the author. Hi, Alessandra.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing great. How are you? fabulous. So we usually begin these interviews with a little bit about the author. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I teach philosophy at Cardiff University. I'm Italian, and the Italian accent, but I've been here at Cardiff for a long, long time. And my interest really is in epistemology, as you said, but I would like also to add in feminist philosophy. And in fact, part of the genesis of this book, as I hope we will discuss, is my interest in issues of oppression and discrimination. And so I think a part of this book as an investigation into the psychology of oppression, as I hope we will have time to investigate. Apart from philosophy, I'm really interested in sailing. And so I always think that my best thoughts are if I have any best thoughts, they always come to me whilst I'm away from everything and I am over the water, hearing the wind in the sails. So that's what I like to do apart from doing philosophy.
Can I ask you about the sailing? So did you grow up doing sailing, or is that something that an activity you got interested in later in life?
I grew up dreaming of sailing, but none of my family were into it, so I didn't. And then when I moved to the UK, where I suppose sailing is something that is very popular, or at least it's very popular along the coastlines, then I got friends who sail, so I really got into it that way. It's something I really like doing. And I mean, this is sort of incidental, but, you know, there are a lot of philosophers who do sail, and a lot of philosophers who sail together.
That's news to me.
So Michael Lynch and I go sailing together, for instance.
Oh, I knew about Michael, yeah, but yeah, I hadn't realized that there are more of you.
And Michael Lynch said, but I only have it from him, that Forda and Dan Dennett used to sail together.
Oh,
whether this is true or not, I do not know. But Jose Zalabardo, who you might know, works on Wittgenstein, also is a keen sailor. So there is a little fraternity of us.
Well, that's fabulous. I grew up in a part of New Jersey that was about a 45-minute drive away from the beach. And so when I moved to a landlocked state, Tennessee doesn't have a coast. that's the one thing my wife and I really miss about living in the Northeast or living in New Jersey is how close it was to the ocean. I suspect you and I could talk a lot about the philosophical advantages of being on water for a long time. But let's get to the book. So the mismeasure of self is, as the subtitle, which I mentioned, states, is a study in vice epistemology. I guess some listeners will be familiar with the idea and the, I don't know if it's right yet to call it a movement, but I guess it is, the movement in epistemology to study intellectual vice. But maybe not everybody will be familiar with that term and that research program. So why don't we begin? Can you give us some background to the development, to the growing number of epistemologists who are paying close attention to epistemic vices and intellectual vices more broadly?
So I think different things have come together to create this field of inquiry. So first of all, the study of intellectual virtues sort of has really come of age. And so it's kind of natural, I suppose, to then wonder about intellectual vices, partly because so much of virtue epistemology has modeled itself onto virtue ethics. And of course, virtue ethics is concerned both with virtues, but also with vices. So it's natural, I suppose, that when virtue epistemology started as the study of intellectual virtues, the moment it moved up, the moment virtue epistemology moved away from a close focus exclusively on the traditional questions of epistemology, so for instance, how to give a conceptual analysis of knowledge, right? So early virtue epistemologists, for instance, I think Linda Zagrzewski, tried to give a virtue epistemological account of the traditional questions of epistemology. The limits of human knowledge, what is knowledge, what is justification, and so on and so forth. But then virtue epistemologists broadened the range of inquiry. So you have people like Bob Roberts, but also Jason Baer, who think of virtue epistemologies as addressing a host of questions, some of which have very little to do with the traditional epistemological questions. And so people have started, for instance, asking how to acquire virtues, how to become a better inquirer. And these general questions about how to do ameliorative epistemology, where ameliorative epistemology is epistemology that is concerned on how to make us better thinkers rather than try to do conceptual analysis. The moment you think of epistemology as addressing a broader range of questions and virtue epistemology as addressing this broader range of questions, then it becomes more natural, I think, to think, well, okay, so we want to find out how to be better thinkers, how to develop, you know, attitudes, traits of character, skills that make us better, you know, then you might wonder, but what is holding us back? What are the bad features? And then the question of vice epistemology becomes a sort of obvious extension. Another thing that I think has come together to make interest in vices sort of popular is that, this might be me, but I think there has been in epistemology a turn away, well, not away, but a turn toward investigating when things go badly. Mm. So if you think there is now work on epistemic injustice, there is work on the epistemology of ignorance, right? So all of these negative terms that epistemologists were not concerned with are now becoming the sustained focus of investigation. I think, but this is speculation on my part, that this is part of a move away from ideal theory in epistemology. So if you think of traditional epistemology, it is concerned, and several epistemologists are still concerned with, norms, right? The norms of belief, the norms that constitute knowledge, the norms of inquiry, and sort of idealize away from human limitations of attention, human mixed motives, and so on and so forth, in order to figure out what are, you know, the norms that ought to, in principle, in the ideal case, govern inquiry or be used to achieve knowledge, and so on and so forth. But when they do ideal epistemology in this way, they abstract away from certain things that are essential to human nature. For instance, the fact that our rationality is bounded, right? That there are limits, that we, our performance declines when we are in conditions of cognitive load and so on and so forth. And as people have become more interested in non-ideal epistemology, i.e. this the kind of study of epistemology that is still normative, right? It's still concerned of how to make things better, say, but it's fully aware of the genuine limitation of human cognitive architecture and the realities, both of social pressures and so on and so forth. Once you focus on that, then you need to understand how things go badly in order to make things go better. And hence, I think, an interest in the negative. And I think, you know, negative terms, ignorance, prejudice, vice, and so on and so forth. And I think vice epistemology is part of this movement. That is non-ideal epistemology that is deeply empirically informed, usually empirically informed with steeped in the study of social psychology, or at least my work is, but others I think are closer to cognitive psychology, while others still I think are influenced by sociology. So if you think of some interesting work by T. Nguyen, again on a negative term, eco chambers, again deeply influenced by empirical work, this time I think primarily in sociology. And so it is, vice epistemology is the study of intellectual vices, and it makes sense if you start to think that the role of the epistemology is to understand, using the empirical work done by others, you know, human cognition, how it really works, and then to use the philosophical skill to both understand what is going wrong and to make a proposal for improvement. And that's what I think I do in the book as well. Does that answer the question? Does that explain?
Oh, absolutely. That's a very, very strong answer and very helpful, I'm sure. The book then, and that's a nice segue into talking about the details in the book. So the book examines particularly virtues and vices of epistemic self-evaluation. But the first part of the book is devoted to spelling out your more general approach or your more general conception of epistemic virtues and vices, where you give an account, as you were just saying, of the way in which your approach to virtue and vice epistemology is rooted in some psychological and social-psychological underpinnings. So can you spell out the broad conception of the intellectual virtues and vices and how they work and how they're connected to psychological work?
Sure. So let me start with two observations. The first observation is that virtue and vice epistemologists, like virtue and vice ethicists, generally presume that what they are talking about are constructs that are real, so that there is empirical reality to virtues and vices. I mean, there are exceptions. Julia Driver, for instance, uses virtue theoretical talk, but is not committed to the real existence of virtues and vices. So if you think that virtues and vices are real features of human psychology, it seems quite natural to try to investigate them in a way that, if it's not informed by empirical psychology, at least is not does not contradict empirical findings, right? Because you're aiming to talk of something that has empirical reality. Virtue epistemologists primarily focused on character traits. And then I've looked at the psychology of personality and personality traits in order to inform their understanding of virtues as character traits. Vices, though, are different because vices are more heterogeneous, arguably, than virtues are. That saying, all happy families are happy in the same way, but each unhappy family is unhappy in his own particular way. There's always many more ways for things of going badly than there are going well.
Right. So, Aristotle has got that quote, says, many are the ways of bad men, but good men have but one way, he says in the first book of the Ethics. Yeah.
So vices are heterogeneous in this way, right? When people started looking at vice epistemology, I think the first book that came out on the, monograph dedicated wholly to the topic, I think is Kasim Kassam's book that came out only last year. And he begins also with the observation that vices are really heterogeneous, right? They are indeed character traits, some of them, things like close-mindedness, arguably. There are also, I think, sensibilities, or better, lack of sensibility, being especially inattentive to certain epistemic features of a situation, having blind spots, for instance, could be a vice, and it seems to be sort of a lack of a perceptual skill, something like that. Attitudes, arguably, being prejudiced is an intellectual vice, but it doesn't seem to fit the character trait mold. styles of thinking, you know, being particularly fixed in one ways of thinking, or always playing devil's advocate, even when it's inappropriate, right? So all of these features of vices show them to be motley and not clearly just character traits. And so Kassim Kassam just says they are heterogeneous and that's just the way it is. I try to find a psychological framework that can acknowledge the heterogeneity of vices, but at the same time find a way of making the picture less messy by saying that they all are built of the same components. And for me, those components are attitudes. And so one of the features, I suppose, of the first third of the book is to provide a framework that I get from social psychology that tries, if you want, to describe what is the nature of virtues and vices, or a list of the virtues and vices of self-assessment. And I claim that they are cluster attitudes. Now, saying that they are cluster of attitudes can generate a lot of misunderstanding, because the moment you say attitudes to a philosopher, they will presume that you're talking about propositional attitudes, things like desires or beliefs. But when psychologists talk about attitudes, they actually have in mind something that is rather different. Although sometimes psychologists think that that's what beliefs are. But,
right.
but attitudes are not propositional states. Attitudes are summary evaluation of an object, where object is meant in the formal sense, and that object is the object of the attitude. So something like really liking chocolate is an attitude toward chocolate, is a summary of evaluation of chocolate as something positive. That's an attitude. And so, as you see, they are very different from beliefs and desires. Attitudes are, as I say, summary evaluations. So you can think, and psychologists think of them as cognitive shortcuts. So the idea here is that at some point in life, you evaluate an object, and you evaluate it along several dimensions. For instance, is it dangerous? You know, is it pleasurable? Is it attractive in whatever way? And then you come up with an answer. And it would make a lot of sense from an evolutionary point of view if you didn't have to work out every time you met an object how you feel about it. So, you know, we don't need every time we meet a venomous snake, or a snake that might be venomous, maybe isn't, to sort of, you know, say, oh, how do I feel about snakes, right? It is useful to have attitudes that are, if you want, the summary of past evaluations. They are immediately triggered by the presentation of the object. So this is what attitudes are summaries of past evaluations. They can be revised, you know, in the light of novel experiences. You might revisit your past evaluation and therefore change your mind, i.e. form a different attitude. And so a case where in the light of new evidence, you reconsider what your attitude is, you then form a new attitude based on the past experience and the novel one.
Right. So the attitudes are the. I guess I still want to hear more about how the attitudes are connected to or related to the states, as heterogeneous as they might be, of the virtues and the vices.
Yes. So So the attitude, I need to say one more thing about attitudes.
Sure. So
attitudes are formed, as I said, as summaries of evaluations, but these evaluations are not necessarily unbiased. So these evaluations that lead to the formation of the attitude are driven, if you want, by a question, right? So the question in front of the snake would be something like, is this dangerous, right? The question in front of the chocolate might be, you know, if I eat it, will people then dislike me, you know? So there are all your assessment of the object is driven by various motivations. And people say that the main motivations are knowledge, right? So you evaluate an object in order to figure things out. Self-enhancement or ego defense, you're assessing things for how dangerous they are to your own self-conception. And you can also assess things for how, you know, how that thing contributes to you fitting in group. Right. So you have attitudes, there are summary evaluations of how an object contributes, if you want, to a certain goal, the goal of fitting in society, the goal of feeling good about yourself or ego defense, and the goal of knowledge. So these attitudes, in addition, can be strong when, not when you have. Strong here doesn't mean that you feel strongly. It means that it's triggered in most circumstances, so that there is a strong association between the evaluation, that is the attitude, and the object, right? So the result then is that, and attitudes can also be part of your definition of the self. They can be central to your own self-conception. So having said all of this, then the view here is that we have attitudes that are attitudes to the self. So this time the object of the attitude are parts of ourselves and especially some of our abilities. So I will, for instance, have an attitude to my ability to speak English well, or I will have an attitude to my mathematical ability. I will have an attitude about whether I'm a good cook or not, right? So these are all attitudes directed to the self. And these attitudes need not be evaluations that are driven by the desire to know yourself, but they can be driven by the desire to fit in, or driven by the desire to feel good about yourself. So my claim is that most intellectual vices of self-evaluation, at least, are based on these attitudes to the self and to one's own abilities, which are either driven by the motive of self-knowledge, and if they are, they are virtuous, or they are driven by these other motives of fitting in society or feeling good about yourself. And when your own evaluations of your own capacities is driven by these motives, it is likely to be off, is likely to be unreliable. And given the role that our own evaluations of our own ability play in guiding inquiry, if that evaluation of the self is off kilter, then that will reverberate through your ability to engage in inquiry. And so you can think of these other things, styles of thinking, attitudes, sensibilities, character traits, as things that ultimately are manifestations of these attitudes to the self, which can be either faulty or correct. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. That was a very elegant way of spelling out the, very rich, it seems to me, sort of conception of the intellectual terrain of virtue and vices that you spell out in the book. So good. Having said that, and put that part of the picture in place. So your account of sort of virtuous self-evaluation sort of has the virtue of intellectual humility at its center. And this virtue sort of invokes, or is in some ways, I guess, maybe composed of others, modesty about one's achievements and a kind of acceptance of one's shortcomings. I'm aware, there's a lot of work being done about intellectual humility. Can you tell us a bit about that sort of core intellectual virtue on your view?
Yes. Sure. So I think you're right. I think intellectual humility actually has two components that can be distinct. And I actually believe that there are people who exemplify one but not the other. But often they are together. And when we think of people as being intellectually humble, we actually think of people who have the combo. So I think the fact that intellectual humility is dual in this way might explain partly why the philosophical but also psychological literature on intellectual humility is so varied. At least in philosophy, there are two guiding thoughts that have created a really bifurcated literature on intellectual humility. The first thought was based on Julia Driver's idea that humility is a virtue of ignorance. So the person who is humble is the person who is ignorant of their own strengths or good qualities. I mean, Driver talks in terms of modesty rather than humility, and I think she's right that this, I disagree with this characterization of modesty, but I think she's right that this is about the modesty dimension of humility. But other people have taken her to be talking about humility in general. So that's the first thought, right? That humility is something about doing yourself down in some way, right? Or being underplaying something. People then have developed this thought in terms of humility being low in self-focus, but sort of not seeing oneself as the center of the universe. And others, famously Whitcomb, Bear, and Heather Butterly, and Howard Snyder, have sort of thought that it's not about underestimating one's own strengths, but acknowledging one's limitations. So you have this cluster of views about humility that link it to sort of acknowledgement of limitation, to ignorance about strengths, and so on and so forth. And then you have a wholly other tradition, I think, in the work on humility. And people who have written in that way, for instance, Ian Church, that think that to be humble is to know your own strengths and weaknesses, right? The person who is humble is the person who knows themselves, knows, how good they are and so on and so forth. And I think people tend to, either belongs to this second tradition, focus on knowledge. Nancy Snow also, in one of the earliest, I think, papers on that tradition, talks about humility as knowing your own limits, but also knowing your own strengths. So people who focus on that focus on, if you want, the intellectually virtuous part of humility, right, which is to know yourself, right? Was the others that sort of tend to talk about the low self-focus and so on and so forth, focus perhaps on aspects of humility that are harder to square with the idea of an intellectual virtue. Why would we be intellectually virtuous to actually be in error about, you know, your strengths and weaknesses, right? So I think that the reason why we have these two traditions about what intellectual humility is because they actually tap on different aspects of what is that in reality a composite. So in my view, what humility is both about strengths and limitations, and it is about self-knowledge. But what it doesn't require is that one gets it right. What it requires is that one is motivated to get it right. So I think especially in what people call epistemically polluted environments, environment that mislead, environment full of misinformation and disinformation, or if you want, early feedback of the wrong sort, people can be motivated to know themselves, but end up with a false assessment, right? Due to the fact that they are being presented with a lot of misleading information. I don't want to say that these people are not humble, because in reality, they don't really know their strengths and weaknesses. They are under misapprehension, right? I want to say that if their motive is a motive of self-knowledge rather than a motive of self-enhancement or just fitting in society, that counts for humility. So somebody could overestimate how good they are, but still be humble. And somebody could underestimate how good they are and still be humble. And I think you can come up with examples. You know, in the book, I talk about the person who, you know, is overestimates the importance of her contribution to biology, right? And does so because it's a genuine error, right? This person should not be, I think, thought of as hubristic or arrogant, right? Simply because they overestimate their abilities, right? They're only rightly seen as arrogant and not humble if, you know, they behave in other ways. I don't know, they boast or they bully other people and so on and so forth. And so I then think of humility as an assessment of one's own abilities, which is not necessarily accurate, but is driven by an accuracy motive. And is the fact that it has an epistemically good motivation that makes it an example of intellectual humility.
Right, right. Good. That's very helpful. But, you know, let's turn to the vices, which for some reason are always more fun. So one is, again, central vice is what you call sort of among the vices of superiority. Particularly, I was keen to have you talk a little bit about superbia.
Yeah, so let me say something about superbia first, if you want, and then I'll generalize to the vices of superiority. So superbia is a Latin term. I am denied a lot as to whether to keep the Latin terminology because it does come across as really highfalutin, and it's something I really dislike. But I have not been able to find a good equivalent in English. Right. And so at the end, I just decided to stick with the Latin term. So for the medieval, superbia was a vice. If you look at translations in English now, they say that is the vice of pride. But because pride, in my view, now in English, is sometimes thought as a virtue and sometimes as a vice, translating superbia as pride would just, I think, mislead. Sure. So, right. So superbia is a kind of arrogance, and is the arrogance that pertains to the people who need to push other people down in order to feel good about themselves. So the idea here would be the person that the only way they can value their intellectual contribution, say, is by thinking of themselves as better than other people. And so it would be characteristics, for instance, of people who feel all the need to put other people in their place, that feel all the time a need to establish pecking orders. So I think philosophies, you know, philosophical talks are full of wonderful examples. I mean, I actually do not know what department this was, but I've heard it so many times. I don't know whether it's an urban myth or it's true, but that there was allegedly a department where every time they invited a speaker to give a talk at the end, I don't know who did this, but somebody in the department would sort of come to an assessment of who won, whether the department or the speaker, right? And then would chuck it up and just say, you know, this year we won 10 times, 5 speakers left crying, you know, or things like that. And I mean, that might be an excess, but one of the points there is, you know, a real concern, not for figuring out the truth or anything, a real concern with establishing a pecking order of smartness or a pecking order of intelligence or a pecking order of argumentative prowess and coming on top, right? So that is superbia, this need, you know, this need to be better than other people, which is driven by this deep need to feel good about oneself and the conception of what it is to feel good about oneself that requires that one is better than other people. So that's superb. And that is the characterization of superbia that, for instance, Dante Alighieri offers in his Divine Comedy. So he sort of says of superbia that it is the vice of the people who whose self-esteem is wholly dependent on pushing other people down, seeing other people fail. So that's superbia. So let me say why it is a vice of superiority and then say a little bit about the other vices of superiority. So I get the term, by the way, vices of superiority from Jose Medina's book, The Epistemology of Resistance.
My former colleague.
I know. And also from McAlister Bell's book, In Ethics, on the Ethics of Contempt, Bad Feelings.
It's a great book.
Yeah, it is a fantastic book.
Right. It's called Hard Feeling.
Hard Feelings, yes.
Yeah. That's a good book.
So I think the way I use that term is related to the way they use it. So I think of a vice of superiority as being sort of having to do with superiorities in three ways. First is the vice of people who feel superior in some sense to other people. They don't necessarily believe that they are superior because, in my view, some of these vices are rooted in deep insecurities. So depending on what your conception of belief is, these people might not be actually believing that they are superior. But they feel superior in some way. But this feeling of superiority perhaps is very fragile and easy to undermine. And if so, therefore, does not count as, you know, being a genuinely held belief. So they are linked to feelings of superiority. They are linked to behaviors that, as I just illustrated with superbia, that behaviors, they are designed to create pecking orders. And pecking orders where the person who has this vice emerges at the top of the pecking order or near the top of the pecking order. And
lo and behold.
And third, I speculate that people who hold positions of privilege in virtue of some immutable traits that they have, like their race or their gender, might be a higher risk of developing these vices. So Medina talks in these terms, right? People who occupy position of privilege lack what Medina calls the kind of friction, you know, epistemic friction that takes them down a peg in some ways. And and because they are in an environment which gives them a position of privilege, makes them smoothes the career for them, they might initially as kids be under the misapprehension that they are better than they are. And then when you are used to thinking of yourself as being good in a certain way, it's hard to come to accept that one is not as good as one, right? It's hard. Once you have you are in a good position, it's hard to come to accept that is undeserved privilege, right? It's difficult to you know, give it up. And so the speculation is that then, you know, people who are privileged in this way are more at risk of developing these vices, because in order not to develop these vices, they need to give up, you know, some comfortable positions and accept some unpalatable truths. So they are at risk. So that's the sense in which I talk about vices of superiority. And arrogance and superbia are one example. But another example are vanity and narcissism, which for me are, you know, the four vices of superiority. Where they differ from each other is how the attitude is, right? So the idea here is that there are attitudes toward the self or aspects of the self, and there are attitudes that are positive, that see oneself as having a lot of strengths and good qualities and so on and so forth, right? Thinking of self as good at math, I don't know, good at drawing, good at whatever, right? And so the idea here is that in the case of the person who is arrogant, these good assessments of themselves and assessment of themselves as better than the average, right, are driven by the need for self-enhancement, i.e. the need to protect the self. So as I said with superbia, right, the person who suffers from superbia can only feel good about themselves if they are better than other people. Why? Well, because their good opinion of themselves or their attitudes to themselves of holding themselves high or as in a positive light are driven, right? They are not assessment driven by the need to be accurate as they would be in the humble person, but they are driven by the need to feel good about oneself. In the arrogant person, in the vain person, they are driven by the need to be liked by other people.
Right.
And so that's why the book is called The Mismeasure of the Self, right? So the arrogant person measures their own abilities not by the meter of accuracy, right? They measure their own abilities by the following meter. How feeling this way about this aspect of myself, does it make me feel good about myself? If it does, then I have this attitude, right? And so the attitude is a faulty attitude, partly because it's very likely to be inaccurate. But even if it was by completely fortuitous coincidence accurate, so say a person who is both arrogant and actually a genius, right? Nevertheless, the attitude is not formed on the basis of the actual evidence, but is formed by way of motivated cognition, driven by the need to only look for evidence of one's own ability and ignore or avoid looking at counter evidence. And so you end up feeling good about yourself, but partly because you only looked for evidence that makes you feel good about yourself. And so you have mismeasured your own abilities. The vain person does the same, but this time what they they appreciate about themselves, what they think is good about themselves, is what other people, what they think other people will like them for.
Right, right, right. Fabulous. So let's talk then about this other class of vice. So we talked about the vices of superiority. There are also vices of inferiority. Can you tell us about those?
Yes. So if the vices of superiority are the vices of people who feel superior, feel the need to push other people down or anyway to establish pecking orders where they are at the top, and they are the vices that characterize people who are privileged, the vices of inferiority are the vices of people who feel inferior, think that they are at the bottom of the pecking ladder. And I also argue that people who are in subordinated positions are more at risk of developing these vices, which is, I don't want to, there is a risk when you say things like that, that you're blaming the victim, right? Right. I don't want to say that people should be blamed for because they are servile or because they are timid. What I'm suggesting is that one of the things that oppression does, or if you want, marginalization and subordination does, is that it warps people's character and it right. makes them into people who are more servile. With servile, I mean, yes, people, you know, people who defer too easily to other people's opinion, who parrot other people, and timid are people who self-silence rather not speak up. So I think that there is a lot of psychological evidence that tends to say that to some extent there are people who develop these features. It's interesting that it's not always as gendered as people think it is, but nevertheless, there are certain associations with gender. And so I'm interested in how people develop these vices. And one of the key features of people who are servile and timid, for instance, is that they attribute, they have a, what is known in psychology, a depressive attributional style. So they see any success they have as a matter of luck or right. how easy a task is, and any failure as evidence of their inferiority. And so I'm interested in, you know, in how these vices develop. And again, I think that these are vices that again are about bizarrely how to fit in society and how to protect the ego. So if arrogance is the fight response to alleged attack, timidity is the flight response
I see.
To alleged attack. And if vanity is the sort of grandiosity aspect of needing to be admired, servility is the deferent aspect of equally needing to be admired. So they both have, you know, these two motivations to be liked and to defend the ego drive all of these biases. But depending on the social circumstances you find yourself in, you will adopt a flight or fight strategy, and you will adopt a grandiosity versus lucky strategy.
I see. Well, so Alessandra, you know, you're very generous with your time. Really appreciate talking about the book. I wanted to make sure, though, that we get the chance to talk about the end of the book, and particularly two notes. So I'm going to sort of build two questions, put two questions into one question for the end of our interview. So the third part of the book talks about how epistemic vices are harmful and potentially the source of moral wrongs. And then the final chapter of the book talks about ways in which epistemic virtue or intellectual virtue might be cultivated, or alternatively, the ways in which intellectual vices could be dismantled. So I wanted to ask you both of those questions. You know, so can you tell us a little bit about the harms and wrongs, and also about the cultivation aspect of the vice epistemology program?
Yes. So about the harms and wrong, basically, as I've hinted so far, one of the characteristics of the vices is that, as I understand them, is that people who suffer from them basically engage in motivated cognition. Their assessment of reality is driven by these two needs, either to defend the ego or to be liked by other people. And because they are driven by these needs, their assessment of many features of reality suffer from what is known as motivated cognition, right? Which is basically a way of biasing, because you two things. One is you'll only look at reality to ask this sort of goal-oriented question, right? Is this good to enhance the self? And you don't ask other questions. But also, if you're, for instance, driven by the need to defend the self, the level of evidence that you require to say, yes, this is a threat, is very low, right? It makes sense that a mechanism, there is a mechanism of self-defense, has got many false positives, right? And so you will have, as a consequence of this, that these individuals who have these biases engage extensively in motivated cognition and therefore are the source of many epistemic harms to themselves and to others, because they will end up with false beliefs. They will end up with thinking of themselves as being more informed than they are, so spreading misinformation and so on and so forth. So they are harmful in to themselves and to others by spreading false information, by trying to spin, trying to convince other people. But also they are harmful because to the personalized devices, because basically they are forms of self-deception. Because if you believe that you're good only because believing that you're good makes you feel good about yourself, if you were aware of that, you would stop thinking of yourself as good. You will see that you're self-deceived. And so, as Kassam says, these vices are stealthy because they are hard to discern by the people who has it. Few people who are arrogant think of themselves as being arrogant. So they are harmful in all of these ways. And if you think that the person who has them is unlikely to see that they have them, then it's really hard to see how they could improve, right? And so the final part of the book is about putting forward, it's about criticizing the idea that all you need to do is to put people in front of exemplars and they will want to emulate them. Again, right? So the people who are arrogant, want to put other people down. They envy, their achievements. And so they are unlikely to want to emulate. So instead, I propose is something that perhaps is counterintuitive, but the view is to sort of make people who suffer from these vices of superiority feel less self-invested and make them reflect on what really is valuable to them. And the idea is that if they reflect on values, they probably acquire a sense that their self is broader than they think it is, and so are less likely to perceive attacks as personal attacks. And so the idea is that a reflection on values should, at least temporarily, ameliorate the situation. Or at least that is one of the things I promote, among others.
Right. And you also are, just last thing, you're also suspicious of the proposal that sort of attributing virtuous states to people is a causally efficacious, causally efficacious way under certain circumstances to encourage their manifestation of the virtues even when they lack them, right?
Well, so no, actually,
it's tricky.
I do agree that virtues is, as Alfano calls it, factitious. So the idea is by calling people virtuous, if that's plausible to them, they become more virtuous. And by calling people vicious, again, if that's plausible to them, they'll become more vicious, which is one of the reasons why, although I think people are blameworthy for their vices, I think others should not blame them. I think it's going likely to backfire and counterintuitive and counterproductive. I don't oppose the idea that calling people virtuous might make them more virtuous if they think that that's possible, plausible as, you know, as a feature of them. I just think that by itself will not particularly help the person who is arrogant, because they already think they are fantastic. If you tell them they are fantastic, they are just likely to think even more than they are, you know, that they are fantastic. But it's unclear that they're going to change their behavior. Well, value affirmation techniques, if you are making them reflecting on values, they are not selfish values. And these people are likely to think that they have values that are, you know, transcendent values, values that are of cooperation and so on and so forth. If you make them reflect on these values, that process of reflecting on these values makes them less defensive, or at least that's the thought.
Right, right. Well, that's a good good point to end on. Alessandra, you know, thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy. It's been a real pleasure talking to you about your new book. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion of Alessandra Tonassini's new book. It's called The Mismeasure of the Self, A Study in Vice Epistemology. It's newly published by Oxford University Press. Thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.